When it comes to raising the debt ceiling and lowering the deficit,
people in Washington still haven't found common ground.
From APM, American Public Media, in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update. Our podcast from Marketplace.org today is Monday, July 11th.
Coming up on the program, investors are preparing for the final weeks of the debt ceiling debate.
We know Greece has a big bad debt problem, and apparently so does Italy. Mm.
And we'll tell you a little later about a four-legged, wet-nosed wine connoisseur ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama will meet today with lawmakers from both parties in search of a deal to raise the nation's debt limit in exchange for trillions of dollars in deficit cuts. We are just 3 weeks away from August 2nd. Which the Treasury Department says is the deadline to avoid a national default.
Let's start our coverage with Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Mark, we're hearing about these different options for deficit cutting, $2 trillion versus $4 trillion. What's the difference between that? How would those affect ordinary people?
Well, tax revenue increases. The $2 to $3 trillion that the House Republicans would like to see in the deal are spending cuts, government spending cuts. That would have to include cuts to entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security. The president wants a bigger deal, $4 trillion, but to get there, you need more tax revenue, either through higher tax rates or through lower tax expenditures. Those are the credits and deductions in the tax code.
And do you think that we'll end up with a deal that does include tax increases or not?
Ultimately, I mean, I think to get to something you might call fiscal sustainability, we're going to need both the government spending cuts and tax revenue increases. It's very questionable whether we'll get that as part of the debt ceiling debate that's ongoing right now. We may not get it this go-around, but eventually we'll have to get it.
And what about the timing? We're getting very close now to this August 2nd deadline. Do you think that they'll reach a deal?
I hope so. They need to. I mean, at the very worst, I think they'll raise the debt ceiling just enough to kick the can down the road a couple, 3 months so the debate can continue through the summer into the fall. But it would be really nice if they could come to a deal, a $4 trillion deal. That would be very good for the economy and really send us on our way.
Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, Jeremy, but sometimes we need a little refresher on what the heck we're talking about these days.
Sure.
And here's one now from David Gura. What we're talking about, of course, the big date in August and what happens if the nation defaults on its debt. And Marketplace's David Gura is with us now from the nation's capital to talk about it. Morning, David.
Morning, Steve.
We've been talking about this debt ceiling for months now. Why August 2nd? Why is that the deadline? What happens on that day?
Yeah, well, on that date, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says the government won't be able to pay back what it owes. We've borrowed a lot of money for highways, for Medicare, for the wars we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now, well, we've got bills to pay. So I talked to Scott Brown. He's the chief economist with Raymond James.
Simply put, if we don't raise the debt ceiling, then the government can't spend the money. It has to make choices as to what it's going to cut, what it's not going to pay.
In other words, if Congress doesn't raise the debt limit, we'll default on what we owe.
Is this a hard deadline, David, or do we have some wiggle room here?
Well, if nothing happens by August 2nd, the government will face some tough choices. Does it cut Social Security checks? Does it pay interest on Treasury bonds? Now, this deadline's been pushed back a couple of times now, and at this point, Scott Brown told me, he doesn't think there's much flexibility left.
The longer this goes on, the more the financial markets are going to express anxiety about the situation. And it's not something I think the markets want to deal with.
Foreign investors might go elsewhere, Brown said. Interest rates would go up. If Congress and the White House can't come to an agreement soon, there are apparently some contingency plans. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he has one, Steve, but right now we have no idea what's in it.
All right. Marketplace's David Gura reporting from Washington. David, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, some have said a debt default could send us right back to a financial crisis. And the one we had just a couple of years ago cost the Treasury more money in bailouts than many people probably realized.
And Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan says the government is actually making a little money on it. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
When you say bailout, Alan, how much money are you really talking about?
$14 trillion and change.
Now, $14 trillion is a lot of money, Alan. Did the government go in thinking there would not be a profit from any of that?
Yeah, the government went in expecting to lose hundreds of billions on the bailout, and they did the bailout in order to keep the U.S. economy and world economy from collapsing. And now, because the government's gotten lucky and things are better, the bailout is going to show an actual living profit, as I define profit and as I define the bailout.
All right. So define profit. What would a profit be?
Based on the numbers we have, between $40 billion and $100 billion, which to me is actual real money.
That's a chunk of change. Absolutely. So where is that money going to go, Alan?
Well, a lot of it has already gone to the U.S. Treasury. What it's done is reduce the deficit and reduce the government's need to borrow. And more money's going to go in this year and next, a lot more, I think.
All right, going to the Treasury. But what about the taxpayers? I mean, we always hear about the taxpayers getting paid back. Are we, Alan, the taxpayers, going to see any of this money?
Well, no one's going to write a check to Chiatakis for, you know, $12 or whatever your share of this is.
$14.08.
Well, okay then. But when they said the taxpayers were bailing people out, they didn't come to you and ask for money. They went to the Treasury.
Speaking of the Treasury, Alan, why isn't the Treasury trumpeting this news all over them? Why aren't they just bragging about, look what we did?
My guess is somebody, probably in the White House, has decided this is all toxic, so we don't want to talk about it, because anytime we mention the bailout, it'll cause endless problems. The Treasury, in fact, has a set of numbers that are different than mine, but along similar lines, and unless you go and extract it with a pair of pliers, you don't know it exists.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan joining us from New York. Alan, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
Aluminum maker Alcoa is expected to kick off earnings season today with strong profits due to an increase in demand from car and airplane makers. And Nestle today offered to buy a majority stake in a big Chinese candy company called Sufu Chi. It's a deal worth $1.7 billion.
Check out more numbers, stocks, and others inside our website, marketplace.org. And today, Jeremy, we welcome the newest stock exchange in the world into the global financial fold.
Where
yes,
is that?
The Cambodian Exchange.
Oh.
Long delayed since it was announced way back in 2007. Unfortunately, we can't tell you how stocks did on their first day because, as of right now, there are no companies listed on the Cambodian Stock Exchange. Yes.
There will be. I'm sure there's a good future for Cambodia Stock Exchange.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
And now to the Marketplace global perspective. European leaders meet today to talk about the latest twist in the European debt crisis. There are ominous signs. Italy could be the next country in trouble with global investors. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on that. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So Greece, Portugal, and Ireland have been bailed out. I thought Spain was next in line. Why are we talking about Italy now?
Politics, in a word. As we know, Prime Minister Berlusconi has been embroiled in scandal for months, but the markets were prepared to give his government the benefit of the doubt while his highly respected finance chief was in control of the public finances. But that control is suddenly in doubt. Berlusconi has fallen out badly with the finance chief. He thinks he's a genius, was Berlusconi's sneering comment about him last week. This disunity has hit confidence. The stock market's plummeted, and the cost of borrowing for the government has shot up, making it more and more difficult for it to service its debt.
Could Italy, Stephen, become as troublesome for the global economy as Greece?
Potentially more troublesome. If it does need the help of its European partners, Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform says that will pose a huge problem for the Eurozone.
Italy is a very big economy. It's the third biggest economy in the Eurozone. It's something like probably 10 times the size of the Irish economy, for example. And they couldn't afford to bail Italy out.
So if Italy needs a bailout, it could be real crunch time. And, Steve, after dragging on for 18 months, this crisis could finally reach some kind of a climax as early as this fall.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Financial regulators from the United States are in China today meeting with their counterparts there. Americans are hoping to address a number of accounting irregularities at some Chinese companies that are publicly traded in New York. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
More than 150 Chinese companies have sold shares here the last few years through what are called backdoor listings. They buy shells of U.S. firms already publicly traded. The backdoor is faster, less red tape, and legal. But Ken Lieberthal at the Brookings Institution says for some Chinese firms,
the information that they're obligated to provide is not accurate.
Scrutiny turned up erroneous books, obsolete accounting numbers, a suspected fake online bank account. Chinese firms may be developing a reputation in New York, and Lieberthal thinks Beijing won't want that.
The Chinese government has, in fact, a substantial interest in having the firms that come here behave properly.
In the past, Chinese tourists going overseas got trained to stand in line, don't cut, don't spit. The same may apply to Chinese companies trying to go global. Still, how much Chinese riffraff is there really? Defenders think Chinese firms are unfairly smeared, and they blame the smearers. They say short sellers spread rumors and profit when stocks fall. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Well, in Australia today, Qantas Airlines says a proposed carbon tax to reduce emissions in that country would result in higher fares. The plan would be one of the most ambitious carbon plans outside the European Union. But as reporter Stuart Cohen tells us from Sydney, there's a lot of debate about the economic costs.
Australia's carbon tax proposal will put a price on greenhouse gas emissions. Big polluters will have to pay nearly $25 per metric ton on emissions. The country's biggest power plant puts out around 40,000 tons a day. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
As a nation, we need to put a price on carbon and create a clean energy future. At the moment, those big polluters can release that pollution into our atmosphere for free.
Food and gas prices are expected to rise as a result, and critics say the carbon tax will slow the Australian economy. But to make up for it, the Prime Minister is offering a raft of tax breaks to the public. It's being called the largest overhaul of Australia's tax system in decades. After 3 years, the tax will transition to a cap-and-trade system, similar to one debated by the U.S. Congress last year. Opponents say Australia shouldn't be taking on such a costly endeavor when the world's biggest polluters, the U.S. and China, are currently unwilling to cap their greenhouse gas emissions. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Well, while there's a move in Australia to get rid of a lot of carbon emissions, a lot of investors continue to pump their money into things like oil, natural gas, and coal. But a study out today says there may be a little too much money going into fossil fuels. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Fossil fuels are a huge part of the financial markets. Pensions, mutual funds, governments, most big investors hold major stock in oil, coal, and gas. The Carbon Tracker Initiative, along with accounting firm KPMG, says those investments may not be worth what we think.
Because the risks of emissions from fossil fuel burnings are not taken into account when the valuation of the companies is performed.
That's Olga Shistakova, an analyst at Point Carbon. She says investors won't factor in the risk of greenhouse gas emissions on their own. Only tougher regulations would push them. Kerry Krasinski follows environmental risk at Trucost. He says ignoring emissions could mean there's a bubble in fossil fuels.
Bubbles tend to form when people ignore risks that could otherwise have been anticipated.
He says companies and investors that measure the risk now and adjust accordingly could be ahead of the curve. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
You know, you can follow us and friend us on Facebook.
And find us on Twitter, too. The program is at Marketplace Radio.
My Twitter address is at Radio Chio.
And mine is at Jeremy Hobson. There are reports this morning that Syrian protesters have attacked the U.S. embassy in Damascus on a day that has seen some of the worst violence since the Syrian government started cracking down on dissenters about 2 months ago.
And so far, about 10,000 Syrians have fled to refugee camps in neighboring Turkey. And as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports from Turkey, the costs are piling up.
When there aren't any refugees, the population of Yeyladağ is a little more than 6,000 people. It's a dusty border town. It has one main drag, which is lined with places like tea houses and small shops. You don't see a lot of refugees around because they're mostly closed in camps on the edges of town, but everybody knows they're here. Mehmet Aktay grew up in Yayladaw, and a couple of weeks ago, he got a job collecting trash in one of the camps, a job he says will probably double his income.
It's a filthy job dealing with trash. It causes sickness, but at least we have a job.
Until the refugees came here, he only worked occasionally. He would drive a tractor on other people's farms. But he's still worried about the Syrians being here. He says the town already has water shortages, and he wonders if Yayladaw can actually handle twice as many people. This bakery, which is on one end of town, has gotten some extra business because of the refugees. Talib Ferengi is the baker. He's putting flatbread after flatbread into the oven while he talks. He says people from the surrounding villages have collected money to buy bread for the refugees. It's happened a few times, and it's been a nice little bonus for the bakery. But Ferengi wishes he could sell more to the camps. The Turkish Red Crescent, which runs them, actually trucks in most of the supplies for the camps, including bread.
Of course, it would be better if the Red Crescent bought from us, but they don't buy from here. They don't buy anything from the local merchants.
His coworker, who's rolling out the dough, interrupts him to say, as if there were no bakers here, no groceries here. The mayor of Yayladaw says he's trying to find ways to help the refugees that would also let the town benefit more from the camps. But the unrest in Syria is causing other economic problems for the mayor to deal with. Yayladaw used to get a lot of its money from border traffic, and that traffic has nearly stopped since the uprisings in Syria began this spring. In Yayladaw, Turkey, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
And finally, on a lighter note, Steve, let's head to Australia, where a key part of winemaking has been outsourced to man's best friend.
Oh.
A bloodhound dog named Louisa Bell has been trained to sniff out a bad barrel and detect bottles that are corked, that have gone bad. Her owners say her nose is 2,000 times more sensitive than a human nose.
Wow.
But apparently, she is not a fan of actually drinking the wine that she tests. She prefers a bowl of water and some dog food. Yeah. I don't know whether she likes to have it aged 10 years or not, but
Maybe a milk bone to go along with that dog food, too. No wine, though, huh? Jeez.
No, and you know what actually is funny about this is that when she decides that a glass or a bottle is bad—
Does she turn her nose up?
No, she tip— she,
No.
She knocks the glass to the side with her nose.
Oh, does she really?
Yeah, very smart.
Oh, bless her heart.
I'm going to bring her with me because I can never— I never know when a bottle of wine is corked. So.
Good luck with that.
To the restaurant. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. I hope you have a great Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.